You are listening to the Cycling Podcast, proudly supported by Sports Tours International. Now, maybe you fancy a trip to the Tour de France later this summer. Maybe the Grand Départ weekend in Lille, or the Alps, the Pyrenees, the mythical Mont Ventoux, or perhaps the final day in Paris is more your style. Either way, Sports Tours International have got you covered, and they can take you right to the heart of the action. Their team of friendly and experienced guides know the Tour de France inside out, which means that you're leaving nothing to chance and you can get the best possible experience out of your trip to the Tour. And the reason I mention this is because way back in 1997, before I became a cycling journalist, I went to watch the Tour de France with my dad. We went to see a time trial at Saint-Étienne, and then the plan was to watch the race on Alpe d'Huez. But we were there off our own backs. We travelled over on our own and we were kind of making it up as we went along. And we didn't really appreciate how big the Tour de France was. And we certainly didn't know how early the roads would close. And so when it came to getting to Alpe d'Huez, we couldn't get onto the mountain. We ended up watching it on a bit of a nondescript stretch of road on the run towards Bourg d'Oisans. And while it was a great weekend, we came away thinking that perhaps we would have got more out of it if we'd gone with some people who really knew what the Tour was all about. And I think that's where Sports Tours International really comes into its own, because their guides really know what they're doing and they can take you on the trip of a lifetime to see the world's biggest race. Go to sportstoursinternational.co.uk to check out the full range of packages. There's a whole host of different trips that you can choose from, including a once-in-a-lifetime trip that will take you inside the race in one of the Tour de France official cars. So go to sportstoursinternational.co.uk and maybe you will be on the road to France later this summer. Now it's on with the show.
Hello and welcoming you on March the 4th, 2025, after a week when, in the unlikeliest reunion since the Gallagher brothers announced their plans to tour together this summer, Rabobank returned to professional cycling, and we'll leave it to you, the listeners, to supply your drug-related punchlines. My name is Daniel Freeber and I'm the host of this episode of the Cycling Podcast, in which we will discuss an opening weekend of woe for the team whose jersey Rabobank will adorn, pronounce on whether it was also an Omloop Kuurne doubleheader to forget for cycling fans, and look forward to both Strade Bianche and particularly Paris-Nice, with one of the favourites to win the latter of those races. Certainly joining me to do all of that today are the Liam and Noel of this humble production, and I think both bigger fans of the aforementioned, not really aforementioned because I haven't said the name Oasis yet, but that ensemble, and bigger fans of that ensemble than I am. It is Lionel Burney and Rob Hatch.
Who's who?
I was going to ask the same question.
both as mercurial as each other.
I think.
Who's the third one? Paul. What did he do? Was he ever part of the band? Paul Gallagher. Was he their manager at one point?
Oh,
I remember he existed. There. Anyway.
Noel was the one with all the kind of the talent, the wordplay. So that's got to be Rob. Liam, the obstreperous one, unpredictable, prone to temper tantrums. So that's me, clearly.
Yeah, I definitely see those similarities, Lionel. Chaps, Rabobank coming back to professional cycling. It had me feeling all sort of 2005, 2007, 2012. Of course, they left professional cycling at the end of 2012. In fact, over many years, Lionel, there was a sort of drip of information, revelations about what had been going on in that team, which was a sort of 20-year-old franchise in professional cycling. And then in 2012, it all came to a head, revelations about the human plasma doping ring in Austria. And then one of the big Dutch newspapers, Volkskrant, ran stories in which they quoted the team's longtime manager, Theo de Rooy, who sort of said that doping had been tolerated for a long time on the team. Of course, Rabobank was the team Michael Rasmussen was riding for in 2007 Tour de France, when he was kicked out a couple of days before the end. Michael Rasmussen, who incidentally, chaps, I texted the other day on the day when this news
You go like to going two-footed, you, don't you?
No, when this news was announced, and Michael Rasmussen, of course, well, he now covers the Tour de France, actually, as a journalist for one of the Danish newspapers, and very affable chap, actually. I get on very well with him. And I texted him and said, I bet it's been a busy day for you. I was going to text him the night before, because I actually got the heads up about this the night before, and I was going to text him and just say, Michael, make sure your phone is charged tomorrow, because I think you'll be getting a few calls. When I did text him the following day, I said, have you had a busy day? And he said, you're the first journalist to contact me, which I was quite surprised about. Given the Vingegaard connection, I thought this would be huge news.
Well, yeah, this is Rabobank, who, as you say, Daniel, their last Tour de France sponsoring the Dutch team, the big Dutch team, was 2012. The first was 1996. So Rabobank were involved in cycling for a long period of time. I was looking back at 96, the Tour de France, to see whether any other sponsors are still around. And the only one is Lotto, the Belgian Lotto, not the Lotto NL, that later sponsored what was the Rabobank team. Rabobank clearly have noticed that Team Visma Lisa Bike are pretty good at cycling now, and they want back in, having dropped the team in 2012. It's been through a few iterations since then, hasn't it? Blanco, 2013, they rode kind of unsponsored. Then Belkin, a sort of, what's that, phone accessories?
Hardware.
Belkin sponsored them for a couple of years, 2013 and 14, and then Lotto NL, and which is a lottery, and Jumbo the supermarket became the sponsors, and now it's Visma Lisa Bike, as we know. It just reminds me a small football anecdote, if you will. Doug Ellis, who was the owner, chairman of Aston Villa Football Club.
Deadly dog.
Yeah, he was the owner chairman for many years, from sort of the late 60s, and then he kind of gave it up very briefly in the early 80s, during which time Aston Villa won the league championship and the European Cup. And then he came back again, and they won more or less nothing since. And it strikes me Rabobank have kind of, they've missed out on the Roglic Vingegaard years, and they want a bit of the action.
Will they get it? Maybe not, based on this weekend. Weekend of woe, I referred to it as in the intro to today's pod. Chaps, I must confess I've had a pretty busy week following other things. Was it revealed, was it communicated, what place Rabobank would have in the team name or on the jersey? We know that this association officially is going to start at the Tour de France. Are they going to become, we remember, it was just about a year ago, just over a year ago, wasn't it, when Visma Lisa Bike were looking for new injections, no pun intended, of funds. And we didn't know which company in the PON. The PON is the parent group, a company that they have Cervelo, but they also have Lisa Bike. We didn't know which of those companies was going to end up on the Visma jersey. It ended up being Lisa Bike, but we thought that might be a bit of a placeholder. It might not be there for very long. So when I heard this news, I assumed that from July we might get Rabobank Visma or Visma Rabobank, which would lead to a bit of a, it might give rise to a bit of an unfortunate colour clash. Yellow and orange do not go very well together, do they? Orange being Rabobank's.
They're right next to each other in colours. The spectrum, Daniel.
But yeah, but they don't really.
Okay.
They don't really go together.
You are talking to a Watford fan who plays with a bit of yellow and red, so you know, somewhere in the middle there. He's not used to, Lionel's not averse to seeing those colours mixed, I guess.
Let's move on
to the newsette, chaps. What item have you brought for us to ponder and maybe pronounce on this week?
Shall I go first?
Yes,
I think so.
It's big Tour de France news, isn't it? Because the grand départ of the 2026 Tour, that's next year, of course, has been confirmed. It will start with a team time trial in Barcelona. And it will finish up on the hill at Montjuic, and it will follow the rules of the Paris-Nice team time trial from a couple of years ago. Daniel, you were there. You'll remember this. You'll probably correct me if I
last
get the
year. And we've got one coming next week as well.
Right. Yeah. So we'll get to see this again. Basically, the stage win will go to the team that covers the course quickest with taking the time on the first rider across the line, but the general classification times will be given according to each individual's time completing the course. So you don't have to finish with your fourth fastest rider to give the team's time. It means that the top riders, the best climbers, can ride their own pace, and it really injects a kind of an interesting tactical dynamic.
Another injection to
the stage. We will likely see the Tadej Pogacar, Jonas Vingegaard, those kind of riders brought into the bottom of the climb by their team, and then try and cover the rest of the course as quickly as possible. So it's quite an interesting format, and that will start the 2026 Tour de France in Barcelona. And the BBC's Dan Rowan had an exclusive, very strong rumours, claiming that this could be confirmed as early as next month, that the 2027 Tour de France will start in Edinburgh in Scotland and work its way down south via Wales and England and then across to France. And in conjunction with that, the Tour de France Femme could well start in Leeds in Yorkshire. Echoes of the 2014 Grand Départ of the Tour de France, of course, where we saw those huge crowds. But Edinburgh, I remember very well, was strongly in the running alongside Yorkshire for that 2014 Grand Départ, and kind of got gazumped, really. British Cycling backed the Edinburgh bid, and, well, they were sort of undone a bit by Gary Verity charming Christian Prudhomme. But it does look very much like a start for the Tour de France in Edinburgh in 2027. So I am looking forward to Pogmanay.
We've already had that. We've already had that on the pod several times, I think.
I think so. Yeah, but in relation to a Scottish Grand Départ, I'm not sure. I don't know. Maybe.
If the Grand Départ was on the 1st of January, then I think it would be appropriate. But that would be a radical move. Speaking of injections, we haven't already mentioned them yet in the podcast. Shall I go next?
Yeah. It's a beautiful segue.
Because in injection-related news, we have had, or yesterday began, the trial of a gentleman called Dr. González Torres, who is a Colombian doctor who worked briefly for the Arkea team in 2020. Now, his name might be familiar, might ring some bells, because I said he worked for Arkea. He was associated with Nairo Quintana. And he is currently on trial because he is charged with using questionable medical methods in his stint with Arkea. He is potentially facing a one-year suspended prison sentence, a €5,000 fine, and a five-year ban from medical practice. Why is this? Well, the investigation began way back in 2020. He'd been taken on by Arkea for the Tour de France. You remember that year with COVID, the schedule, the season was rearranged, reshuffled, and the Tour de France happened in September. Well, he was taken on for the Tour de France by Arkea, and Nairo Quintana was in Colombia with the other a lot of other Colombian riders during lockdown, flew to the Tour de France, which was starting in Nice, made a stop in Madrid, and in Madrid was searched by police, and they noticed that Nairo Man was transporting an awful lot of physiological saline, which can be used, among other things, to dilute blood and to bring one's hematocrit down. There was no action taken then, but the French authorities were alerted, and during the 2020 Tour de France, Nairo Man was a marked man, particularly on the stage to the Col la Loz, both on the morning of that stage and in the afternoon. Nairo Quintana, but also his brother Dyer Quintana, who was also riding for Arkea, their room was searched. So both before the stage and after the stage, investigators found suspicious medical supplies, including used transfusion kit, an empty saline solution bag, tourniquet, syringe with a needle, and several blood-stained compresses. As I said, Gonzalo Torres was working for Arkea, and he was or had previously worked with Nairo Quintana. So he'd sort of been recruited to the team on recommendation of Nairo Quintana. Now, this trial and yesterday's session sort of focuses on what was found in those raids. The tourniquet, transfusion kit, compresses as well, blood-stained compresses. Both Dyer Quintana's DNA and Nairo Quintana's DNA were found on the compresses, I believe, blood-stained compresses, or Dyer's DNA was found on the blood-stained compress. Yesterday it was all about establishing whose DNA was where and whether this incriminated the doctor, whether it incriminated Nairo Quintana or Dyer Quintana. Lots of other sort of revelations or bits of kind of insight into the methods of Gonzalez Torres, which were sort of teased out yesterday. It brought back memories of some of the stories we used to get regularly, sort of 10, 15 years ago, and painted Gonzalez Torres as a sort of a guru, Svengali type figure. Chaps, there were anecdotes about him. We got this in court yesterday, apparently. Anecdotes about him waking riders at dawn for rectal cleanses using lemon, garlic, chamomile, and coffee. He also gave Colombian riders numerical sequences to repeat in their heads to aid their mental equilibrium during races. Obviously, these methods are very much above board. But his fate ultimately will be determined by what is decided about what was happening with these transfusion kits and syringes. Arkea are a civil party in the case, and they are claiming significant reputational damages. They claim they lost over 4 million euros in sponsorship deals due to the scandal. Call it a scandal. Not too much information about this leaked at the time. We knew that those raids had taken place on the day of the Col de la Loz stage. L'Equipe reported yesterday there were actually 11 raids conducted on Arkea over subsequent months. Of course, Nairo Quintana left Arkea in 2022 after another scandal of sorts when he tested positive for Tramadol, which wasn't banned, but was a controlled substance at the time. But that led to Quintana leaving before his contract was due to expire. And of course, he's currently at 35 years of age, back with Movistar and in his second season with Movistar.
To be honest, Daniel, yeah, you think about Nairo Quintana, you think about the Tramadol thing, yeah. Maybe in sort of wanting to forget that part of cycling from a few years ago, you sort of compartmentalise it. Yeah, there was an issue there, but it's easy to forget maybe that there's two separate issues here, and that really does sound the sort of warning alarm for me. Let's see what justice decides and justice says, and if it isn't good news for the doctor involved, then I guess that Movistar might have a decision to make.
You would think so. And as I sort of alluded to, we haven't had this kind of story in professional cycling for a long time. And it sort of, it kind of colours your view of what might still be happening. Mm. Not widely, but we did think that this kind of thing was, or it did really belong to a bygone age. However, here we're talking about 2020, not that long ago. Rob, what news do you have for us?
Well, I'm going to go to Northwest Spain, to Galicia, and it's sort of interconnected with what was happening in France at the weekend. I'm pretty sure that if you watched or managed to catch up with the results from a couple of the one-day classics in French, the ones that offer a bit of an alternative to the cobbles of the north down in the Drôme and the Ardèche, there were some fantastic places yet again for XDS Astana without winning. Third, fourth and fifth on the race on the Saturday. In total, they picked up 313 points, UCI points, from that race. Whereas over in the Gran Camino, for winning the stage, Magnus Cort picked up 14. He won three stages and didn't even pick up anywhere near as many UCI points as Aston added from that race. And yes, we can argue about the system. We've known what the system's been like for the last couple of years, and you know the teams have to adapt to that, don't they, if they want to avoid relegation and what have you, or make sure they secure the wild cards a bit further down for next year. And we've already covered the fact that that's what XDS Astana are trying to do this year. It's working out very, very well for them, let's say, because they've chopped at least 1,000 points off the deficit they had to Cofidis right now. It's going in the right direction after just a month and a bit. But Ezequiel Mosquera, and we were just talking about problems that certain riders have. He of fame, for one reason or another, let's say. He's now the director, the race director of Gran Camino. And I must say that in this job, he's doing a fantastic job, because I was really impressed with the race itself. It's a small race. The TV coverage was brilliant, though. Superb quality. The riders seemed to be happy with what they saw. But he wasn't happy with the start list. There are only three World Tour teams there this year. Of course, they've been spoilt so far, haven't they? Alejandro Valverde winning the first one, Jonas Vingegaard then going and winning the next two editions. This year it was the first GC victory for Derek G, very first stage race win for him, so he'll be pretty happy. I think Canadian fans will be happy, given the fact that only Grand Tour winners have won it before then. But Ezequiel Mosquera talking about the point system with the UCI and saying, well, if they don't give us more UCI points for winning our races, then people aren't going to come anymore, certainly when they're reliant on picking up points to conserve their World Tour status. There's probably a bit more to it than that, maybe the calendar as well. I think, Lionel, you and I were talking both on and off the mic last week about the amount of racing that there was recently, certainly the week before last, when I think we had about 50 million stage races going on at the same time. We're going to have the same next week with Tirreno Adriatico and Paris-Nice. So I think that they've decided that they will try and ask for a date change and probably lean on the weather as a reason for the date change, because we all know that in Galicia in February, it can be pretty filthy, the weather. So they're going to try and do that. But a bit of discontent there about the point system. And again, goes back to what we were talking about with one cycling and everything. Races really fighting for their very existence and fighting to have a sort of meaning.
Just on that, I wonder whether bumping O Camino up to 5 days this year had an impact on the start list. I don't know. It could be a factor. Maybe more isn't necessarily greater.
On a similar note, chaps, Magnus Cort Nielsen winning... How many stages did he win? Three, Rob?
Three.
Three. Just on that, that idea of sort of quality over quantity or quantity over quality... Uno X, I read something earlier today that Uno X have raced very sparingly so far this year. Only done, I think up until a few days ago, they'd only done as a team 25 race days, as compared with Movistar, which had done 50. And this is part of, well, their strategy to accumulate points this year, to be very focused and to really target races where they think they can score. And it's working well so far, isn't it?
I'll tell you what, if they haven't raced that very, very much, they're doing pretty well, because they're 13th in the UCI rankings, picking up points from those very few races. So they've had a tremendous start.
Well, they had an excellent day on Saturday, which we will discuss next.
Chute, chute à l'arrière du peloton, cycling podcast team car at the back of the pack, please.
That's Seb Piquet, the voice of Radio Tour, to remind me to tell you that this episode is also sponsored by Indeed. Now, if you work for an organisation that's looking to hire somebody, Indeed is all you need. You obviously want to hire the best possible person for the job, but you also want to fill that vacancy quickly, because the longer it's left vacant, the more strain you're putting on other members of your team. So Indeed can solve all of the problems associated with hiring people for your company. Indeed sponsored jobs will help you stand out from the crowd and hire the right person quickly. With sponsored jobs, your post will jump to the top of the page, attracting the eyes of the best and most relevant candidates. And that means you can reach out to the people you want to interview more quickly and fill your job with the best possible person fast. It makes a huge difference too. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applicants than non-sponsored jobs. Plus, with Indeed sponsored jobs, there are no monthly subscriptions, no long-term contracts, and you only pay for the results. So how fast is it? Well, in the minute that I've been talking to you, 23 hires were made on Indeed worldwide, according to Indeed's data. There's no need to wait any longer. Speed up your hiring process right now with Indeed. Listeners to the Cycling Podcast will get a £100 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at indeed.com/cycle. Just go to indeed.com/cycle right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on the Cycling Podcast. Indeed.com/cycle. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
Well, chaps, on Saturday it was Happy Omloop Day. Does that still happen on social media? Oh God, it makes me go. I always hate that. I hate that. It's one of my pet peeves. Happy Omloop Day. Well, 306. How many days is it now? 359 days until Omloop. That's another one I hate. Sorry if anyone's offended by that, or if anyone
absolute
did write that.
Absolute killjoy.
Anyway, it was opening weekend.
It was
opening weekend at the weekend with Omloop Het Nieuwsblad and Koerner Brussels. Koerner, we're going to discuss that in just a second. But one man who was rejoicing, I imagine, to a certain extent, was our very good friend, Hugo Corvitz. I sort of introduced him in last week's podcast, introduced this new feature that we're going to be running throughout the Cobble Classics in particular. Corvitz Corner, Hugo, very, very long time correspondent of Het Nieuwsblad. In fact, the oracle, really, on all things Belgian cycling, Belgian classics. He's retired this year. He's missing it. He's getting real sort of pangs of nostalgia. But he was at the roadside, I know, at the weekend. And he delivered his verdict on opening weekend for us in this week's Corvitz Corner.
Pay attention, freebie. I learned very, very little from this Omloop Het Nieuwsblad. What a strange race that was. I mainly remember that almost everyone was afraid of everyone. Yes, even Visma Lise Bike was afraid of UAE team Emirates and vice versa. Everyone assumed that we would get a duel between those two super strong teams, but it was opposite the Koning who actually came up with a power grab after the Molenberg. That was very unusual, if you know that the Roadhoofs team never gave in during the first tough race weekend in recent years. Jasper Philipsen was the man of the weekend, with a third place in the Omloop Het Nieuwsblad and the victory in Koerne. He is the only one who can look forward to the rest of the season with confidence. That is not yet the case for Wout van Aert and Visma Lisebike. His team showed very strange racing behavior. On Sunday, Van Aert even came up with a chasse patate to Koerne. If this had happened in the past with Museo or Bonen, the newspapers would have been too small. It used to be the custom for the Flemish media to judge and condemn after the opening weekend. But it was more of a game. There is also no reason to judge or condemn. Van Aert is now going on a training camp to the Teide and will not compete again until the end of March in Harelbeke. I expect a different Van Aert there who can compete with Pogačar and Van der Poel. The A3 Saxo Classic remains the marker for the Tour of Flanders. Anyone who does not play a significant role there should be very, very worried. Conclusion, we have not learned much from this boring Omloop Het Nieuwsblad. Who would have dared to predict that Søren Werenskjold would win? A Norwegian who has hardly any knowledge of the terrain in Flanders. It couldn't be much stranger. Although there is one certainty, the Viking will not win the Tour of Flanders this year. That is what history teaches us.
Pay attention. Very strange racing behavior from Visma Lisebike.
Yeah, there's a t-shirt slogan if ever I saw one, Daniel.
Definitely. We'll discuss the very strange.
Get it printed.
We will discuss that in a minute. It's kind of the equivalent of Hugo's very strange racing behaviour is kind of the equivalent of someone posting Visma Lisebike's tactics on Twitter in a quote tweet and just putting odd, full stop. That's.
And then I would have to quote tweet that and put this.
This, yes. Nail head. nail head. Anyway, Rob, tell us who won, just in case anyone didn't grasp, but we'll gather it from Hugo's dispatch there.
Søren Varnechov won. And I have to say that even in the commentary box, we were rather late to spot him coming up. You know, we're all looking on the far side that I was watching Manier against Phillips, and just out the corner of the eye, you could see this red bullet racing towards the line in the camera. And what a sprint from Søren Varnechov there to get the better of all the big names who were there. Nobody talking about him, quite rightfully, because, you know, he's not really been there in these races before. And as Hugo was saying, he wasn't even meant to ride the race in the first place. He only came in last minute to the start list. He was meant to be targeting Curran on the Sunday. And, well, what a dream day. And you'd have to say that's their biggest win ever, isn't it, Uno X?
I would say so. And the first Norwegian winner of Omloop since Thor Hushovd in 2009, I think that was.
Yes.
But a fantastic sprint. I mean, those three were a good couple of bike lengths clear of the rest, weren't they? But I was kind of doubting myself. I was a bit down on the racing over the weekend, especially given the enthusiasm with which we all felt very enthusiastic after our preview on Friday, didn't we, Rob? I was really looking forward to the two races. But I think, you know, that's sport, isn't it? You know, sometimes it doesn't turn out to be the rip-roaring spectacle that we all hope. And I was wondering whether I was being a bit unnecessarily down. So it was a relief to hear that Hugo Kordovits, who has, well, he's seen more editions of Omloop than I've had hot dinners. It's close, but talking about, doesn't he?
Yes.
Yes. Well, he's the oracle, as you say. And he thought it was a boring race with some very strange racing behaviour. And I think that's a pretty good summary.
Yeah. Do you know what, chaps? I think that the kind of fetishisation of Omloop is quite a recent thing. I mean, Hugo said there, he made the point about the Belgian press, particularly, I don't want to say in his heyday, because Hugo is still very much in his golden age. But once upon a time, the Belgian press would fill newspapers, in effect, with the sort of post-mortem after Omloop Het Nieuwsblad. However, I remember sort of back in the dim and distant sort of past when I started covering cycling, that Omloop, it was...
In the olden days.
Yeah, it was seen as much more of a, well, to use a phrase that Lionel was sometimes employed for the Tour Down Under, a bit of a kind of a curtain raiser, a bit of a sort of charity shield, and it wasn't that prestigious and wasn't that important. And I feel only in the last sort of 15 years, maybe partly due to people saying Happy Omloop Day and only 331 days into Omloop on Twitter, but seriously, I feel that this race generates more hype now than it did once upon a time. And I also feel as though, looking back, thinking back to that period at the start of the noughties, we often used to get quite a turgid spectacle. Now, I know the route was very different then. We'll come on to the route in a minute, because I also think that's a bit of a turkey. And I think there's some misguided nostalgia about the Moore and Bosberg combination. But Lionel, would you agree that this race has taken on maybe outsized importance in people's minds?
Well, I think there's a line, isn't there, between when it was kind of ushered into the Pro Tour or the World Tour. Previously, it had been a bit more of a warm-up event, the opening day of the season for certainly the classics riders, the first big objective. But I think, you know, we've seen teams and riders taking it seriously since probably, when? 2008, 9, 10, something like that. That's when it kind of jumped up a bit.
It wasn't a Pro Tour World Tour. I remember starting commentating this race 2013 when Paolini won, and it wasn't World Tour then. That change has only happened in the last decade.
Yeah, I think that's probably what has given it the greater importance. But I think it boils down to one simple factor, really, over the weekend, which was the weather was too good. It wasn't nasty enough. I mean, it was bright and sunny. It was cold, slight fresh headwind on the run in, and that meant that, you know, there wasn't the kind of the war of attrition that you kind of need for a classic edition of Omloop? Because bear in mind, it is just under 200 kilometres long, so it's not got the distance to really sort things out in that final sort of 80 to 100 kilometres, which is what we see at the Tour of Flanders, for example. So, you know, if no one attacks and breaks the elastic sort of early on that loop with the Haghoek and the Lieberg, there is always a risk of it all staying together. And I mean, I referred to the 2021 edition that Davide Ballerini won in a similar sized bunch sprint as an outlier, because it kind of was. Well, now we've seen another edition very similar with a slightly bigger bunch sprint. And just a little bit of statistical analysis, it's got the highest percentage of finishers of any edition of Omloop Het Nieuwsblad of all time. 89% of the starters finished. There are only 19 non-finishers of the 174 who rolled out. And the previous closest figure to that I can find, 2013, there were 145 finishers and 45 riders who didn't make it. That's 76% of the field that finished the race. So I think the stats there say that, you know, whilst not, you know, it's too easy to say it was an easy race, it wasn't difficult enough to create the real spectacle that we wanted to see.
There was a moment on the Langemunter, which, if you think back to Omloop past, when it was, as you and I were joking the other day, Ghent, Lionel, that used to be the final cobbled sector with about, 20Ks to go on the way back into Ghent itself. I think we were at 95, 96Ks to go, something like that, and there was a slight win there. UAE really tried. As soon as the camera started rolling, the very first images we had, Langemunter, which really is only in the race to pay tribute to the old finish now, but that was the only little bit of action we saw for around 50 kilometres after that, really, until we got to the Eckenberg and the Molenberg. They tried the UAE, but the wind just wasn't blowing strong enough. Like you said, the conditions probably too good.
Did we also see some underpowered super teams in particular? We'll talk about the strange racing behaviour of Visma in a minute, but they are slightly underpowered at the moment. They don't have Christophe Laporte. Wout van Aert's preparation, I mean, there's a big...
Didn't have a bad side out though, Jeff, did they?
No, they had a bad... But I remember, Rob, this time last year, we did a podcast and we looked at their team before Omloop Het Nieuwsblad, and I suggested it was the best team ever fielded for an Omloop Het Nieuwsblad, maybe for even for any classic. Of course, Van Baarle was in the team then as well, and Laporte was in the team. They've been missing both of them, although Van Baarle is coming back. So they're slightly underpowered. Van Aert, that's another question. That's another topic that we can talk about in a minute. Obviously, Pogacar wasn't there for UAE. They still have a strong team, but you know, the Morgado, you feel as though he's on the threshold of a big breakthrough, but he's not quite there yet. Bora Hansgrohe, they had bad luck with the defending champion. Trantnik had a puncture, didn't he? An inopportune moment. But they didn't, a lot of the bigger teams didn't really have, either didn't have their A team or are not yet, certainly, as you would expect, in their sort of A condition. They're not yet quite al dente, are they?
Well, I think a bigger factor was Alpecin de Koenig taking control of the race into the Molenberg and getting on the front. And they were the ones that were kind of driving it over the top on that false flat and forced that real... only significant split, wasn't there, which separated Matteo Jorgensen from Wout van Aert. Jorgensen of Visma Elisabike was in the first group with Jasper Philipsen. The likes of Paul Manier was in there. I think Tom Pidcock was in there at that stage. Whereas Wout van Aert was in the second group with Jan Tratnik, Niels Pollitt, Morgado, Narvaez, and Arnaud Delis, who had fought his way back in after a bike change, hadn't he? So that was kind of the moment where it was the sprint teams against the kind of attackers, and it was sort of the wrong way round. You know, the sprint team was on the offensive with numbers around Jasper Philipsen, and the kind of the breakaway riders, the ones that would have been looking to try and put the sprinters on the back foot, they were actually a few too many of them were on the back foot. And so there was this period where the race all kind of came back together again in the around the sort of 30 kilometres to go mark. And then it was a bit like, well, this is now inevitably going to be a bunch sprint unless somebody can force a split away on the Mur. And the problem was the brake, the bunch was too big. When there's that many riders, it's just so much harder for anyone to get away, because if one or two get away, there's loads of people to chase. If five or six get away, they just keep going across and across and across on those roads until suddenly the front group's bigger than the second group. And so it did feel like a sprint finish was inevitable from that point on, even though there was still time for a little bit of a split on the Bosberg as well, with 18 riders away, and it all concertinaed back again. It was just a race in which things almost happened but didn't quite. And credit to Stefan Kuhn of Groupama FDJ for really putting everything on the line. He wasn't going to win a sprint, obviously. He had nothing to lose, and he tried. And I felt there, if somebody else had slipped away with him, been a bit more attentive when he made that move, we could have seen a different finish. But it never really looked like it was going to go any other way than a sprint finish. The surprise there is that Jasper Philipsen then didn't win it. Alpecin de Koenig had done nearly everything right, but Philipsen didn't have the legs on the Saturday, but he made up for it on the Sunday.
I just add as well, you talked about Stefan Kuhn there and Philipsen. One thing that you know, we perhaps failed to add in our first little sum up of the race, it was a headwind from the Bosberg into Ninova, and a headwind sprint as well. And you go, it wasn't blowing a gale, but if you don't time it right in the sprint, if you're out there on your own, it makes life extremely difficult, doesn't it?
Yes. Just on that run in, Bosberg, Bosberg, I'm not a big fan. I think it gives rise to three or four different scenarios, which we've seen. I mean, you could probably say that about most, you know, different. You could say that about the Paterberg loop currently in the Tour of Flanders. But there is a lot of nostalgia around the Mur and the Bosberg. And so many times we've seen the scenario that we almost saw with Stefan Kuhn, a rider counterattack, go away, Tratnik last year. I'm thinking back to André Tchamil in the Tour of Flanders all those years ago. Was it 99 or 2000? And I think there is a sort of unnecessary or unmerited wistfulness around that double header.
You're bursting all the birthday balloons this week, aren't you, Daniel?
That's my job.
I see what you're saying. I think the thing is that with the Tour of Flanders, there was that extra 50 or 60 kilometres, which made it much more significant, that run in and the difficulty of it, and the fact that everybody's on their knees by that stage in the race. Whereas after, you know, 180 kilometres reaching that point, it's not quite the same. It's a little bit of a weaker finish. It still looks nice. That's the thing, isn't it? The Mur looks fantastic. The Bosberg could be a little springboard, but like I say, it all comes down to the numbers. Unfortunately, you know, if that group had been, you know, half the size, we might have seen it break up a bit more. But because it was so big, the odds were always on everything coming back together.
The Mur's a funny one, because I know, Daniel, you know, you're talking about people's nostalgia. I know the organisers are desperate to have it in their race because it looks amazing and everybody talks about it. You know, we're talking about it now. Maybe not so much the Bosberg. The Bosberg comes because it was what came after the Mur on the way into the old finish of the Ronde van Vlaanderen. But to include the Mur in the Tour of Flanders nowadays, it's difficult. They did try for a couple of years, didn't they? It's just, geographically, it's too far away from where the rest of the main climbs are. Even now, coming from the Berendries then, and what was it, Elfrenberg, Vossenhall that came after that, it's another 15, 16 k's before you even get to Herzberger. And if you do that on the way back again in one of the other races, and let's say we move the finish back to Ghent in the Omloppet Nieuwsblad, it's just too far away, isn't it? So I understand the organisers got a really difficult thing, because they want to include that imagery in their races. But it's difficult, isn't it, to have that and then produce the same sort of finale we get in Tour of Flanders, when you've got that Quadamont and Paterberg loop, which, for the record, I'm a big fan of. I think there's been some tremendous races there in the last few years. I know that, again, people who are on the other side of the coin, the traditionalists, were saying, oh, I want the Mur and Bosberg, but you've got to decide. You can't have everything in the same race.
I think it's familiarity which leads to predictability as well. I mean, when I first covered Omloop Het Volk, as it was then, the last climb was a long, long way from the finish, possibly 80K from the finish, because they finished over in Lokeren. And the big thing about that run-in was the fact they went over a few sections of really quite hard cobblestones. And there are some hard cobbles in Omloop Het Nieuwsblad as it is now, but, you know, there's nothing kind of towards the end that really makes it a race of attrition. The incentive is to wait and see and then hope that the Mur is going to be the thing that decides the race. And when it doesn't, the outcome is going to be a sprint finish. I mean, Daniel, you're going to have to wait a little bit longer because Ninova is going to be the finish of Omloop Het Nieuwsblad until at least 2028. I think they've signed a new contract. So this is what the riders are going to have to work it out. And I think cycling in general, you know, there was such anticipation, enthusiasm, excitement for these two races. And I'm not saying that sprint finishes can't be good, but I think there is a danger if too many of these kind of races, because Koerner went the same way as well, if they end up in big bunch sprints, I think there's a risk that the interest will wane. There won't be the kind of, you know, the appointment to view events that perhaps they could and should be. And I think that's unfortunate for the sprint type riders like Wellens-Cold and Philipsen and Manier, of course, who was second. You know, they deserve their opportunities to win these kind of races as well. But there's something undeniable about the fact that it's more interesting to watch when it breaks up a bit more.
1,231 days until Het Nieuwsblad 2028, when it will still be finishing in Ninova. And that's, I've just tweeted it. One like so far. Just a couple of notes. You mentioned him there, Lionel Manier, second at age 20. Very impressive. We had him in Corbett's Corner last week, didn't we? Hugo was very excited to see how he was going to get on. He's clearly one to watch for the Spring Classics as early as this year. Sam Watson rode very well to finish fifth. Not only a very good sprint to finish fifth, but he was very close to the front of the race throughout the last sort of 60, 70 kilometres. A good period at the moment for Ineos, as we have discussed. And just on Wellens-Cold, I don't know about you chaps, but I see him. I know he can do a lot. He's a good time trialist as well. He was under 23 world champion time trialist, wasn't he? He reminds me a lot of Marcel Kittel, and I just wonder, in the fact that, you know, he has come from time trialing, and I see him developing as a really, really good bunch sprinter, but I don't know if he sees that for himself. Rob?
I was hanging around our studio at the weekend, and I think Adam and Steve were talking about the amount of watts that the guy puts out, and it did make me think of Marcel Kittel, because apparently he does put a silly number of watts out when he sprints, so he's hugely powerful.
Daniel, you mentioned Sam Watson there. I thought Ineos had a decent day, and Josh Tarling was away, wasn't he? Not off the front of the race because the brake was still up the road at this point, but I thought he had a dig. And that was the sort of move that others perhaps should have reacted to and joined forces with, because, you know, a strong time trialist riding on those roads, slight headwind, cross headwind, you know, they could have put quite a good move together. But as I say, everyone was waiting. And just a note in dispatches for the defending champion, Jan Tratnik. I mean, 1 year, your luck's in, you get an armchair ride to the finish with Niels Pollitt. The next year, a puncture at pretty much the worst possible time in the race, coming down the hill into Hellersberg and just before the Mur, flat tyre, and that was game over for the defending champion. But overall...
I already mentioned that. That's all right. It's fine. No, it's fine.
We can mention it twice. He's a defending champion.
I was so blown away by your anti-Omloop rhetoric that I must have missed that.
He's still recovering.
It's fine. I think it's envy. You're a real Grand Tour type of guy, aren't you? You've got a bit of a downer on the classics, man, are you? Generally.
The best races are the ones that resemble summer holidays. Chap, should we talk about the Donkey Derby, Koerner Brussels Koerner? Maybe we should dive into this strange racing behaviour, because here in this race I would suggest we saw the main exhibit, I would say, that Hugo's referring to, and Wout van Aert's riding in particular.
Well, was it a mistake, or was it just that he didn't have either the cooperation from Roger Adria?
What was it, Lionel? First of all, what was it? What are we referring to? The chasse patate.
Yeah, he got away, didn't he, on the Kluisberg, which is the last climb. There's then a long way to go to the finish, 58 kilometres, I think, from that point to the finish. Not saying it's flat, but there's no kind of climbs to speak of from that point on. And Van Aert set off in pursuit of the remnants of the break. There'd already been a move that had gone across. Who was it? It was Tim Wellens, Stefan Bissiger, and Hoob Arts had made it away across to the front six to make it nine up front. Van Aert had also had a bit of a go earlier on Hotond to try and shake something down, and that didn't work. But yeah, then he went away, was marked by Roger Adria, who for Red Bull Bora Hansgrohe was doing the policeman role for Jordi Meu. So no criticism of Adria for not coming through and helping, but Van Aert was kind of neither one thing nor the other. He wasn't strong enough to get across, and he wasn't quick enough to call it quits and go back. I think it was just like he had a card in his hand, and it was the four of clubs, and he played it, and that was it. And I don't think it was necessarily indicative of some kind of great terminal decline for Wout van Aert's strength.
He's washed. He's
not
finished.
He's washed up now. That's it. That's
Van Aert. Van Aert fell off.
Game over.
Get Nygaard back.
I was on the. I was travelling during the race. Actually, and I landed. And I think I opened up, and the first couple of messages I got were something like Wout van Aert chasse patate. I obviously couldn't believe what I was reading, but. Yeah, a bit of realism. You're right. A bit of realism with Wout van Aert. His objectives are very much further down the line, and they are monument-shaped races, aren't they?
Mm.
And if Olav Kooi had won the sprint and not Jasper Philipsen, then the way we evaluate it all would be completely different, and we'd be saying, oh, what a great job of work Wout van Aert did, putting the pressure on in that crucial 50-kilometre to go phase of the race. It's always determined, the way we look at these things is always determined by how it ends up and who wins. I mean, Alpecin De Koninck had a much quieter day, but they won Jasper Philipsen on his 27th birthday as well. Nice little present for him.
Caden Groves as a lead out man felt like a bit of a cheat code, didn't it? Although Caden Groves was subsequently relegated. That was for celebrating, wasn't it?
It was. And I tell you what, you called it a cheat code. Well, I think other teams are going to have to phone the cheat line to try and find some tips if they're going to get to the next level in the Tour, because it seems that Caden Groves would like to ride the Tour de France. And I think you and I actually talked about, maybe in one of the Welt episodes last year, Daniel, that if Caden Groves wanted to ride the Tour, it was going to be difficult. Well, I think the way through is that he's going to ride in support of Jasper Philipsen. And it's, add maybe Mathieu van der Poel into the mix as well. Pretty scary, that, isn't it?
Mm. So what did he do? It was for celebration. What was his celebration? Did he go to the corner flag, rip his jersey off, and and it had a slogan on it? Some kind of like very strange racing behaviour on it.
Fantastic.
Chaps, just on the sprint, not too much else to say, is there, about Koenen. Jonathan Milan, in a weekend that was slightly sort of off colour, I would say, for Little Trek. Jonathan Milan finishing sixth, and it reminded me a little bit of the European Championship last year when he sort of fluffed his lines a little bit, and I think people have been very quick to anoint him the new sprint king. And he can be on his day, because I think he probably puts out more watts than anyone and is faster than anyone on his day. But he's a work in progress when it comes to executing in the biggest races.
I think in sprinting in general, and we've noticed it in the last 2, 3, maybe even 4 seasons, that it's changed. I don't think we do have these eras at the minute where you have one sprinter who is so dominant on above the other. It's been a sort of a mishmash, and they all go through periods. You know, we didn't have the sort of the Cavendish era, the Kittel era, the Greipel era, that sort of thing. I don't think that happens at the moment.
No, a case in point there would be Tim Merlier of Sudal Quickstep. You know, he won twice at the Alula Tour, won twice at the UAE Tour, but then, you know, really was kind of second division of the sprinters in 15th place at Kerner Brussels Kerner. I mean, it was a biggish group. It wasn't like a bunch sprint where there was sort of real sophisticated organised lead out. So it was kind of freelance sprinting, wasn't it? Daniel, you make the point there about Caden Groves and Jasper Philipsen. I mean, that was a great teammate for Philipsen to have. But everybody else was just relying on whatever resources they had and kind of swinging from wheel to wheel. And yeah, it's, like I say, a kind of freelance sprint rather than a conventional bunch sprint, which might give rise to some of these, what you would think of as slightly more unusual results. Just before we move on to discuss the rest of the racing and look ahead at next week, a couple of things to update you on. First of all, you may remember the Grand Tour Cups, which were created by Stacey Snyder. The money raised from the sale of those cups was donated to the West Lothian Cycle Circuit up in Linlithgow, where there is Buffalo Bend, in tribute of our dear friend and co-founder Richard Moore, who passed away 3 years ago. Well, the Cup's money has been put to good use, and four clubs, the Edinburgh Road Club, which is Richard's old club, Falkirk Junior Bike Club, Stirling Bike Club and West Lothian Clarion, have created the Richard Moore Youth Race Series, which will take place once a month on Tuesday evenings from April to August. And the races are open to girls and boys aged 10 to 15. So that's under 12s to under 16s. And those races will all take place on the circuit in Linlithgow. A fantastic initiative. The series was held last year, but we are delighted that the organisers have come together and would like to name the series after Richard as recognition for his contribution to cycling. So we'll mention the racing in the 1101 Cappuccino as the season unfolds. So the first event will be in April. And if you are listening and you want to take part, or you have a child aged 10 to 15 who wants to take part, go to the British Cycling website and you can find those events and enter them. The 1101 Cappuccino that I mentioned, you can sign up and receive updates from us in your inbox. Go to thecyclingpodcast.com. And there's a special episode for Friends of the Podcast coming any day now. Simon Gill and I went to the UCI Gravel World Championships last October in Leuven. And as we are between Omloop Het Nieuwsblad and the gravelly race, Strada Bianca, I put together a special episode looking at where the gravel scene is now and where it may go next. So that episode will be in Friends of the Podcast feeds probably Wednesday, I think. I'll upload that tomorrow.
Chaps, some other races we didn't get around to mentioning in the first two parts. Well, first of all, we had the women's Het Nieuwsblad, and then we had another race in Belgium, which wasn't Kerner Brussels Kern, but it's sort of the equivalent. It takes place on the same day. Any volunteers tell us what happened in either of those?
Yep. I tell you what, the women's race, I was about 11 kilometres, I think, from the finale. We'd just gone over the Bosberg and Kung was about to go away. And I got a message in my ear. Okay, you know, we're going to promote the women's race, which the broadcast comes after the men's. And I can tell you that the gap is at 13 and a half minutes. I almost dropped the microphone. 13 and a half minutes, and they were into the final 50 kilometres. So that already set up what was a brilliant race. And I don't want to step on the Cycling Podcast Femina toes by talking too much and going too much into it, but some brilliant stories there. You know, the Damien Follering versus Estee Works, all the politics and waiting and squabbling. What a narrative that sets up for the spring and potentially to the Tour de France as well. And Lotte Klaas, first ever professional win. She was from just up the road in Saint-Nicolas, former, I think it was a military style reality TV shows, a bit like sort of SAS, Who Dares Win sort of thing. You know, I think she'd been out there on Belgian TV before. Brilliant. Just some fantastic storylines. So Women's Nieuwsblad providing lots of talking points for the Cycling Podcast Femina, which, Lionel, I guess is coming out
next
pretty
week,
soon.
Yes. Well, there was also the longest sprint finish attempt, wasn't there, by Aurelia Nello, who finished second. Yes. She opened up the sprint with about a kilometre to go, it looked like. And that was a bold move and didn't work out for her. But quite a thrilling finish, wasn't it?
And chaps, we had two races in France at the weekend. The first one was a fiasco, a shambles. Another one. Shades of the Volta Algarve last week when the peloton went the wrong way. This race, the race I'm referring to, was the Foun Ardèche Classic, and it was won by Romain Grégoire of Groupama, who took advantage of that cock-up by a large... It wasn't a full peloton, was it? The race had split by that point. But Grégoire, who I would suggest would have been one of the favourites in that finale anyway, but he duly went away and won that race. And then the following day, we had a bit of a demonstration, a bit of a tour de force by Juan Ayuso of UAE Team Emirates. I don't know how many UAE Team Emirates that is who have won races already this season, but they're all winning. And he went away, set up by Isaac del Toro, about 40 kilometers from the finish, and romped to victory by a sizable margin. I don't have the margin in front of me, but I think it was over a minute.
I think that's seven UAE Team Emirates riders who've won races: Narváez, Morgado, Jan Christen, Adam Yates, Tadej Pogacar, Pavel Sivakov and Juan Ayuso. Yeah, they're spreading the wins out pretty evenly amongst themselves there, aren't they?
Indeed. With the longest breakaway he's ever attempted, apparently, 40 kilometres, and it came off. So, you know, something that someone else can do in his team, he will obviously try and do as well.
Ayuso, who is, we think, well, he has said, he's building towards the Giro d'Italia, isn't he? He's going to be one of their leaders, along with Adam Yates of the Giro d'Italia. Chaps, a couple of other races we should mention. I mentioned fiascos. There was another one, the Tour of Rwanda. I'm not going to give you a comprehensive breakdown of exactly what happened, but the race was won by the Total Energy rider Fabien Dubé. And I suggest that listeners, if they want to find out more about what happened, with effectively Total Energy sort of blocking the road and making sure that Dubé didn't lose his leader's jersey on the penultimate stage, I think it was. If you would like to find out more about what happened, I would direct you to the Team Africa Rising blog. So that's teamafricarising.org, who Jeremy Ford was there on the ground, and he delivered some fantastic blogs, detailed everything that occurred in Rwanda in great detail. Of course, that was a bit of a dry run for the World Championships in Rwanda later this year, very contentious, controversial World Championships. The Foun Ardèche Classic, that was also a dry run for the European Championships, taking place, I think, on that exact course later in the year.
I hope the signs are better.
Yeah, so I hope the signs are better there. Actually, incidentally, after that Foun Ardèche Classic, Romain Grégoire pointed out that he had gone the right way in the Algarve as well. And he suggested that the Groupama riders were receiving a higher quality of briefing than some of their rivals' competitors.
Can I just say
just final footnote on that. Ironic, really, because very famously, maybe the most costly cock-up at a roundabout in recent years documented in professional cycling was Thibaut Pinot on the Stade d'Albi in the Tour de France in 2019. There was a fly on the wall documentary about that Tour de France, about his team in that Tour de France, and there were a lot of recriminations about the DSs not telling them which way to go on a particular roundabout when the peloton was split to shreds in crosswinds, and it cost him over a minute, and we thought at that point could cost him the Tour de France. In effect, what happened was that he abandoned that Tour de France with an injury. Anyway, Rob, sorry.
No, I'm sorry. I just wanted to say a penny for Filippo Ganna's thoughts after seeing that the results stood on Saturday.
Well, the reason for that, obviously, was because it was a one-day race, so I guess they could leave the order over the line. But it's inconsistent, isn't it? It just doesn't seem right. I mean, I stuck up for Ganna a couple of weeks ago. But yeah, Romain Grégoire got the win, even though a lot of the riders went off course. There was also a car that had just stopped in the... finish straight as well, which some riders sprinted round. A lot to be desired with some of the small race organisation at the start of this season. Just on Rwanda, Daniel, you mentioned, and we tend to think, let's keep politics out of sport. Well, I mean, that's I don't necessarily think that's an appropriate view. International sport is to a degree political, but the European Parliament has called on the UCI to move the World Championships from Rwanda, so we'll continue to keep an eye on that as the season goes on. And just before we talk about Strada Bianca, Paris-Nice, Tirreno Adriatico to come, Matthew van der Poel is making his season debut today in the race that was until this week known as Le Samin. It's now Ename Samin with a sponsor's name on the front. But Matthew van der Poel, a slightly late addition to the start list there. We'll see how he gets on, and we'll probably discuss that next week.
Indeed, chaps, on to coming events in professional cycling. At the weekend, we've got the start of Paris-Nice. I'll be there in the grimy Parisian suburbs, usually cold, wet, pretty miserable. But that is, that's all part of the race's charm, those first 3 days in Les Yvelines. Two or three days.
Is it?
Yeah. You know.
I used to love seeing the sea after about five days.
The beauty is in the eye of the beholder here. I mean, is this a race that resembles one of your summer holidays, Daniel?
Yeah, well, we'll hear from a rider in a minute whose memories are Paris-Nice are linked more to those kind of stages than the sort of second, the sunnier second half of the race. So we've got Paris-Nice starting on Sunday, and also on Saturday we've got Strade Bianche, of course, and that will see a return to action of the defending champion, Tadej Pogacar. Same route as last year, chaps. We remember that last year the route was extended by, what was it, Rob? About 30 kilometres.
Yeah, there's an extra small loop, wasn't there?
Yeah.
Pinzult on all those sort of sectors towards the
end. And more cobbles. So
cobbles?
Quickly, not cobbles. Cobbles.
Gravel.
Gravel. The other thing.
Obstacles.
The other thing. Are we going to see an exact facsimile, an exact identical action replay? Of course, Pogacar has attacked in the same spot. It's just beyond the summit of the Santa Maria climb, isn't it? And it's actually on a descent where he has attacked twice and won. One was a 50-kilometre breakaway because, as I said, the route changed. Last year was an 80-kilometre breakaway. Are we going to see the exact identical scenario again? Lionel, you mentioned Mathieu van der Poel coming back today in Le Samin. He apparently is not going to ride Strade Bianche.
No. Too hilly for him, apparently, according to his team.
Pogacar, repeat. I've just seen that he's said that he's a little bit stronger than he was last year, which is reassuring for anyone who was worried.
Well, I mean, last year the gap was 2:44 to Tom Schuyns. Significant gaps all the way through the top 10. You know, I mean, 10th place didn't get within 5 minutes of Pog. Well, we'll have to see, won't we? I mean, there's a few different factors. I mean, you know, there's always punctures and mechanicals, but I mean, we are getting to the point where it looks like punctures and mechanicals are potentially his biggest obstacle than some of the other riders. But we'll have to see. I mean, it's a difficult enough race that it would be pretty extraordinary if it fell to him 2 years running in pretty much the same way. I mean, last year, that break was, what, 80 kilometres, wasn't it, give or take? We'll have to see. It will all be down to what kind of mood
we'll
he
have
has.
To see.
We will have to see. See. I mean, that's the whole point, isn't it? Let's be really enthusiastic about it. And you know.
Yeah.
I mean, the TV coverage actually provided by the host broadcasters only really starts at about, I think, roughly 100 kilometres ago. Maybe he could sort of challenge that and go before even the cameras start rolling. Mm. Maybe the organisers might have to work with him and say, hang on a minute, you've got to wait until we see it on the telly.
Mm. Blood has been extracted out of stones more easily than speculation has been extracted out of Lionel Burney. Anyway, let's leave it to someone else to speculate a little bit about the other big race starting at the weekend, Paris-Nice. One of the favourites, I would suggest, a man in form, recent Ruta del Sol winner, Pavel Sivakov. That was his first stage win for couple of years, 3 years, 2 years.
Stage race win.
Stage race win, sorry. His last one had been the Vuelta a Burgos. Am I right? I haven't got this in front of me, Rob, but I'm going off memory.
I remember looking it up last week, and it had been for at least a couple of years.
It was indeed the 2022 Vuelta a Burgos. I'm talking, of course, about El Siv, Pavel Sivakov, the Frenchman, 27 years of age, UAE Team Emirates rider, formerly of Team Ineos. Pavel has been ill over the last few days, but he reassured me when we spoke yesterday that he was going to be ready for Paris-Nice, and he certainly has big ambitions there. We're not sure yet whether UAE Team Emirates are going to field Brandon McNulty. He was due to ride, but he had a crash in those French races at the weekend. Joao Almeida will certainly be there. I would suggest to you chaps that the big favourite is not Jonas Vingegaard, who's also going to be riding, but the other Visma Lisa bike rider, Matteo Jorgensen, who on the route that we've got this week in Paris-Nice, Lionel, we talked about the time trial earlier and the funky format. I don't think there's anything there that will scare, particularly worry Matteo Jorgensen, sort of 7 kilometer climbs and so on. Anyway, Jorgensen the favourite for my money, but I think Siv will give him a run for his money. Let's hear from Pavel Sivakov, shall we, talking about Paris-Nice.
Okay, you're on the record.
Yeah. Yeah, I heard that.
Anything you say can be used in evidence against you.
Okay, I'll be careful.
Yeah, make sure you do. Where are you? You're in Andorra?
Actually, now I'm in Girona. I was supposed to do Dromardèche, and because, you know, with the travel from Andorra after Ruta del Sol, I booked something here to avoid extra travel, and then at the end I ended up not racing. I got sick, so actually it's not a bad thing to stay at sea level to recover also and avoid also again the travel, so
okay,
not bad.
Not sick to the extent where it will cause problems next week.
Hopefully not. Obviously, it wasn't the perfect. I didn't have the perfect week. I didn't train that much. I mean, also after the race, you know, I wouldn't have trained a lot. But obviously, I spent like 2-3 days in bed. I had a bit of fever, so obviously, it's not ideal. But I'm starting to get back to training, and yeah, feeling wasn't amazing the last few days, but hope I still have half a week to recover a little bit of good sensations, and we'll see. I mean, I'm not too worried. There's nothing I can do, so just do my best now, and I think yeah, the condition might be a little bit worse, but maybe I'll have a bit more freshness at the same time as well.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. Well, congratulations, Pavel, for Ruta del Sol anyway.
Thank you.
I wanted to ask you, I mean, when we had a long conversation at the end of 2023, we talked a bit about your confidence, and we talked a bit about how your confidence had maybe taken a knock over the course of a couple of seasons, you know, various things, crashes, illnesses and whatever. But it seems like from the outside, it looks as though, especially since last summer, like since the Dauphiné, I suppose, last year, it looks as though you've really sort of, well, you've regained whatever confidence you'd lost and, you know, gone beyond the level you were at previously. Is that how it feels?
Yeah, definitely feels like this. Obviously, I worked, on this, on my confidence with the coach as well at the same time. But I think it was a long process. I think what I gained a lot as well is I got back this way of racing. I used to race when I was younger with UAE, and you know, even the way I won Ruta del Sol last week or like 10 days ago, it's really the first 2 days I was just seeing a breakaway from far away, and I always enjoyed, you know, being more racing, more attacking. Even the back end of last year, you know, in the Vuelta, I did this quite a lot. It didn't work out as I wanted to be, but I got close a few times. And I think just also, yeah, just being maybe a bit more myself on the bike and on the races, that this also helped, I think. Yeah, I think it's, of course, the confidence, but also, I don't know, being a bit more relaxed when it comes to the racing. Also, I have to say, having such a strong team, it helps, because it kind of frees you when you go ahead of the race. You have always a couple or even more strong riders behind covering your back. So in our team, I think sometimes this is even how it works. Someone goes up the road, and sometimes if you're strong enough, you have to be this first guy going up the road, because then the team will back you, and it's quite often a team strong enough to back you until the end when it comes to GC. And yeah, we could see this also actually in Algarve, where Jan won the first stage and then the team was backing him until the end. Obviously the TT was different, but yeah, that's how it works in our team. And yeah, I think, yeah, for me it's been great. I was chasing, I won in Abruzzo last year, I mean quite early in the season. I was looking for, like, let's say a bigger win, like Ruta on the second part of the season. I was getting close quite a few times, and yeah, it's nice to start this year like that. For sure, it's like, I think it might even free me, kind of the way I will be chasing the victories, but I won't have the, maybe sometimes in some tricky situations, I will be more calm. And I think it's how it works sometimes with the riders. You see, if someone can win early in the season, then they are kind of freed maybe from an internal pressure for the rest of the year.
Yeah. Just on, so on this sort of different style of racing and a kind of freer, more sort of liberated way of racing. Did you know that, or I guess hope that this is what you would get at UAE, or has it been a bit of a pleasant surprise to you?
Yeah, I have to say, in a way, yes, that's not exactly like I hoped about this, but I could see in the way they raced that it was already a bit like this, attacking with different riders. Obviously, when we go to a race with Tade, it's everything for him. But then on the other races, I think sometimes in the team, it can also maybe not be counterproductive, but, you know, because we are a lot of riders having, let's say, our own like opportunity on races. Maybe sometimes, you know, it will be less riders working for you to put you in good position on like some crucial points, and we'll be like maybe more we'll be using the other teams and trying to help each other the same way as racing for each other. Sometimes it can be a little disadvantage, but at the end of the day, we always have our own opportunities. And I think it makes riders, let's say, kind of happy. At least for me, it makes me happy. Sometimes it's me, sometimes it's other riders who take these opportunities, but I think I knew that I would get this, because I got, when I was talking with the team already, they said, you will be also coming in the team to try and win races, not just to be a workhorse and work from A to B on all the big races, because yeah, it was obvious that there is a lot of really good riders, but I also didn't want to join a team to work just to work. And I think now I have a really nice balance for this.
I guess the question, well, you guys will probably get a lot this year, especially if it carries on the way it's going, is, well, how long will you all be happy to stay there? Because there are bound to be occasions, maybe not when Tade's riding, but throughout the rest of the year, when you feel strong enough to win, and as you said, another guy gets sort of punches first, as it were, and or you know, you want to try leading a Grand Tour and that's not possible. I, you know, so far there haven't been many sort of public shows of discontent or, I mean, obviously a lot was made last year of Ayuso at the Tour.
Yeah.
On the Galibier. But have you experienced any frustration yet? Has there been a race where you would have liked to, you know, be the leader, or and another guy is either attacked first, or, you know, the DS is there?
Personally, no. I think for me it's been all, like, I had some opportunities, and no, it was just up to me. Also in the Vuelta, I was actually quite free to do whatever I wanted, and for me personally this never happened, but I could see maybe some other riders maybe being a little bit in this position of not having this sole leadership. For sure, for maybe for some guys it's frustrating, and I remember seeing like an interview from Mark Hirschi. Maybe that's also, let's say, that's maybe also what happens to him, because in my opinion now it's going to be more difficult for him to win as much as he did last year with UAE, because like I said, he always had plenty of riders covering him from behind, and now he's going to be against these guys who are going to be chasing him down if he's moving in a breakaway or something. But I think he was looking maybe for this sole leadership where every race he goes, there is no question mark about almost every rider from the team, like, working for him and putting him in good position. That's maybe like moments where you save a little bit more energy.
Yeah.
But I think it goes both ways. It depends really what you want and at which stage of the career you are. There is never a perfect world. It's like I say, for him, if he really wants to win as much as possible, and but not being the sole leader, UAE is a great team for a rider like him. But if he really wants to experience at this time of his career, go and ride like as a sole leader, he made definitely the good choice. But yeah, I can see you this question, like maybe some guys they want this, but yeah, I mean, I think also when everyone signed here, they know that it's not going to be the case. So at the end, you cannot really complain. You signed, you agreed, you made a deal. You know how good are the riders in this team. For me personally, at the moment, is a win-win situation. Like I won in Ruta, having strong guys also with me, around me, recovering me was great, and I think there will be some more opportunities like this for me. For the moment, I'm really happy, and I have nothing to complain about.
And as far as Grand Tours are concerned, are you penciled in for the Tour and the Vuelta, or...?
Normally, if everything goes well, just the Tour. Okay. No Vuelta. Actually, in this, we talk with the team in the second part of the season, I would like to focus more on one day racing and go for my own opportunities there. I quite enjoy one day races, and I think I should do a bit more of them. It works quite good for me.
Yeah. Okay. And Pavel, you mentioned confidence, and you mentioned your coach there. Were you talking there about mental coach or?
Yeah, I did work with a mental coach last two years. So I think it's been quite helpful for me just to actually gain a little bit of this confidence that I missed.
What's the main thing that you've got out of that, or how have you had to explain to someone very quickly why it's been effective for you? What have you done with the mental coach?
I think we've been more focusing on positive thoughts, positive thinking, and also actually I was talking about enjoying the racing more, and was more about also we really focused about this, about enjoying the races, enjoying what I do really. And I think it was a period also of my career when I was maybe putting too much pressure on it, you know, and not enough enjoying of the racing, like just being a bit more free. And I think is a lot of also a lot of that that helped me, being more confident now. I think it's also still an ongoing process. I think as athlete, you always work, you always get new situations in your life, new ways to think and how to approach stuff. So yeah, it's still ongoing, I think, but I think thinking more positively, I think it has been something I was not really good at before, and now I really start to do it more and more, and it definitely helped.
So, Paris-Nice, I guess you guys have lost Brandon McNulty, is that right?
I'm not sure, actually. At the moment, I'm not aware of what happened yesterday. I've seen that he finished quite far back in the peloton, and I heard there was a crash. I don't know what happened.
Yeah, I'm not 100% sure either. But so, presumably, though, you're going to Paris-Nice, so you've got Joao Almeida, and this is the race that you want to do well in on GC, I'm guessing.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, on French soil, and also Paris-Nice has always been, let's say, one of these races like that I used to watch when I was coming back from school, because they were on France TV. So it was like always these big ISO races for me, something special. Dauphiné, Tour, Paris-Nice.
What's the memory of Paris-Nice from you? Have you got a picture in your head of an edition of Paris-Nice that you would have seen when you were a kid?
Not really an edition. In my head, it's just these first stages, like the Vallée de la Chevreuse. This is how I picture the Paris-Nice, really. It's not so much the later part of the race. It's really like these first opening stages, like...
not the nasty cold ones.
Yes. Yeah, it's always tricky. For me, it's one of the trickiest races of the calendar. It's really about getting through the first 2-3 days. And after that, it's actually quite simple. But these first 2-3 days is always complicated with, crosswinds, crashes. And yeah, it's going to be about getting safe through this period. And then the leg talks. And actually, it's going to be also interesting with Team TT this year, with the same rule as in 2023, which is quite nice. So, we'll see. It's going to be a nice test.
And how are you feeling about your time trialing at the moment?
I mean, it's all right. It's not so bad. I've never been like a poor time trialist, but I never... I've been excellent. Yeah. I always, I cannot produce the same power output as on the road bike in the TT position. But I've been working, not so much at the moment because of the racing and also, a little bit of sickness this week. But I think TT is different. It's not only, it's about the team performance, how smooth is the team, is really... we've done one actually with half the Paris-Nice team in Balenciana this year, so that was a nice practice. Joao was there also. But it's completely different. I think actually riders like, I don't know, let's say in Balenciana, like Jonathan Milan, Consoni, these type of riders can be really good in a Team TT because it's like shorter bursts of power, and then you kind of recover in the wheels and then go again. Then let's say a team that we had there was on the paper really good time trialist, Brandon, Joao, but it's not such a consistent effort. It's really spiky. And I think it's going to be really important, obviously, for the GC, and hopefully we can do well.
And then otherwise, it looks like there are a lot of, the main test is sort of 20-minute tests, I guess, so 6-7 kilometers, that kind of thing, the climbs.
I've seen it's not the also the when we finish in Oran, I think on Saturday, it's not the hardest climbs.
No,
It's going to be quite tactical, and then the last day obviously is always fireworks. And really a 20 minute test. I've seen it's quite twisty all day, the in when we finish in Loge des Gardes, I think. It's quite twisty all day. Maybe some teams would like also to open this stage a bit earlier, which would be nice. Not just waiting the final, but yeah, we'll see. We'll see what happens.
And Pavel, you'll get a good look at Vingegaard over the next week. Ahead of that, what would you tell people about Tadej and how he looked over the winter and what you expect from him over the next few weeks?
Well, honestly, as usual, he looked very strong. I think he confirmed it in UAE Tour. He was kind of, in his own league. I think they can expect the same from him on the next races. For me, in my head, is always like, I wish for him that nothing happens, like punctures or stuff like this that are not in his control. But if everything goes well, physically, I don't see anyone, being stronger, especially on a race like, let's say, like Strade, where it's physically really, really demanding, and that's where he strives the most. That's where he has his advantage. I would say even on the paper, a race like UAE Tour, where it's just one effort is maybe, where maybe some guys on pure watts per kilo can get close, but... when it's really hard, and that's where he's at his best. He's just incredible for this type of efforts.
I'm just curious to see whether he goes in exactly the same place again in Strade Bianche.
Yeah, I guess that's the place to go, because it's also the hardest part of the race where everything's stretched out. And I think I don't know if he's gonna go again there. I didn't speak with him about Strade. But I wouldn't be surprised if the situation is right for him to go. I think he can go again there. I mean, nobody, if he has the legs, nobody can stop him.
Pavel, have you got time? I just wanted to ask you two quite random things. One, Vingegaard apparently using these 150 millimeter cranks. Well, first of all, what length of the cranks that you use, and what's your reaction? What are your thoughts on 150 millimeters?
Well, I was actually really surprised when I saw this. I heard that Visma were all switching for shorter cranks, even shorter than 170. I think the whole team, I heard this winter, were going to 160, 165.
Yeah, I think I read 27 of 29 riders have gone to 165 or something. That's what I'd read, but yeah.
And 150 is really extreme. I guess also, I'm not sure the brands are even producing this short cranks. I don't know what's exactly his theory behind. I guess it's to open up this hip angle. I mean, that's why I use 170 this year. I was on 172 before on the road bike. On the TT bike, I was on 170 already. I guess it does make sense to have a more open hip angle. Maybe that's the theory they have behind, like to basically be able to push better, being more comfortable on the bike. I would say this is quite extreme. If it works for him, if he feels comfortable, why not?
Would you notice instantly if you went from, say, 172.5 to 170, would most pros notice instantly, do you think?
Maybe 2 centimeters, maybe not everyone.
Okay.
I guess it depends how.
Five, you would, yeah.
But five for sure. Already, I feel even like 172 to 170. I feel like I have a higher cadence. Like it's not a big difference, but just the feeling you have.
Yeah.
It's different, and it's more of like higher cadence.
Okay.
It's a bit also more comfortable when I go in the aero position. That's for sure.
All right.
But yeah, I don't know if everyone would know this actually. Some riders, I think, some riders actually they don't know this much. Some do a lot. Like, you know, even with a cleat, when somebody is, you have some guys are really picky with the position of a cleat or yeah, even sure. the saddle. Some other guys are actually. That is what I have the feeling. Sometimes he doesn't feel everything and he can just go.
And last thing, Pavel, I was going to ask you, I don't know if you saw this piece in L'Équipe last week about reducing speeds in the peloton and various ideas that people have got for safety. And obviously, bracket sizes, gear, you know, chain ring sizes, that's one that's come up quite a lot.
But yeah,
there's this other interesting idea about tires and, you know, a standardized tire in the same way that they've done in Formula One. What are your thoughts
about the gears actually? About the gears, I was thinking about this. I also seen like some pros and cons, and actually maybe if at the end I don't think I think maybe it's even more of a, like, if you are strong with a bigger gear, you can actually, let's say, overtake some people. Maybe on some like crucial moments there will be less of a bunch up, because that's what causes the crashes, is when everyone is next to each other, when everyone is fighting for this exact same position. I have the feeling that sometimes with the bigger gear, yes, we tend to go faster, but also if you have the legs, you can move up a little bit faster.
Yeah, I think someone said that in the piece. I can't remember who it was, but someone made that point.
But yeah, I don't know if yeah, it's true that every year is getting like, now on the, even on the road stages, some guys use 58. Before it was, I heard in UAE Tour, some riders were using this kind of gears on the flat, and also was it Alula or whatever. So this is becoming kind of crazy. But at the end, they're also not going 58, 11 all the time because it's kind of impossible. So yeah, the tire thing actually could be something, because obviously some of the tires, some of the teams have, let's say, less grippy tires or faster tires, and that's, in a way, that's where you maybe have an advantage and you can work with this, develop also better tires. But if everyone has the same, makes everyone more even. And yeah, you can, like, you cannot overcook a corner then. Maybe if you have a worse tire that is not as grippy, you will go always a bit slower, lose some positions. So I could see maybe a standardized tire that could be a nice idea for everyone. So everyone has the same limit, and you can also make the compound a little bit slower, so the speed is less. Yeah, you have less speed. That's for sure. I don't think the gears are that much of an impact. Like, yeah, maybe in a downhill when it's really, really fast, you can go faster because of a bigger gear, but definitely on the flat, I think it's actually more of if you have the legs, then with a bigger gear, you can move up better and you can actually maybe wait sometimes a little bit more. But yeah, this is how I see it. I think maybe some guys see it differently.
Yeah. I can't see the tire thing. I mean, it's a good idea, but I just can't see it happening, because I mean, they've done it in Formula One, but you've had a lot of the same conversations in, like, in golf, for example. Like, okay, different, it's not about safety there, but the courses are getting too short effectively, so they need to make the ball go less far, and they talked about having a same ball for everyone, but, you know, the manufacturers are just never going to go for that. But
yeah, I cannot see the tires as well, because it's so such a big part also of the industry. They have new tires coming here and there, and also would stop the evolution, I would say, of the tires as well at the same time. So maybe the gears could be something, but I don't know. Like we do in juniors, but I remember junior racing, and it was not much safer than we have. It was actually crazy. Like, everyone would have this gear, and everyone is on one line fighting for the same corner. And at one point, you are out of gear, and you cannot go anywhere. And the guy next to you is the same. So that's where I think if you have the legs, then you can move up more easily
Yeah,
with a bigger gear.
It's like when you're driving, being in a car that accelerates fast, it makes you, it gives you a, well, it's much safer, you know, it gets you out of trouble. Like if you're in, like, if you drive an electric car, which accelerates super fast, like it gets you, you know, it gets you out of trouble, you know, if there's like a problem at lights or whatever, or,
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. Okay, mate. I've outstayed my welcome. I was supposed to speak to you for about 15 minutes, but.
No worries.
Thank you
very
much.
It was a pleasure.
And I'll see you at Paris for the weekend.
Perfect.
So, chaps, that was Pavel Sivakov. It was a much longer conversation than that, I must say. He was very generous with time, was Pavel yesterday, El Siv. Lionel, I think you will be able to confirm this, that our listeners will be able to hear that whole conversation later in the week on Substack. Is that right? On the 1101 Cappuccino?
Why not? Yeah, we can embed the audio in the 1101 Cappuccino, which will be out towards the end of the week.
Excellent, excellent. And chaps, on that note, I suggest we end today's episode there. I won't be back next week. I'll be sunning myself in Les Yvelines.
On your
wiping the grime off my face in Les Yvelines in a strip mall adjacent to Orly Airport, probably.
Enjoying your March summer holiday.
Yeah, exactly. But some sort of motley cast will be back.
Oh, we'll cobble something together. We'll gravel something together for Strada Bianca, Daniel.
Yeah. Very strange podcasting behaviour will be in evidence next week. Okay, chaps. Thank you very much. Have a good week.
It's been a pleasure.
Thank you. Well, I was just going to say, this is traditionally the week where the peloton splits in two, isn't it? Half go to Ponies, half go to Tirreno Adriatico. So I think it's only right that we do the same, I guess. So yeah, we'll be reunited after Ponies and we'll get your thoughts on the race to the sun in a couple of weeks' time. But have a good time out there, Daniel.
The Cycling Podcast was created in 2013 by Richard Moore, Daniel Freeb and Lionel Burney.